This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Dubai port operator deal hits more trouble in the U.S. The chairman of the House Armed Services Committee says GOP leadership will conclude, quote, "These aren't the folks you want to operate your ports." But at the intersection of private industry and security, America is vulnerable in far more spots than just ports. An attack on any one of 100 U.S. chemical plants could kill 1 million Americans. Nuclear power plant security? Thin. Whether the owners are in Dubai or Alabama, private industry is not stepping up. Critics say a too friendly government hasn't asked them. Up next on Point, getting serious about security on the commercial front. We'll be joined by several guests in this hour, including Congressman Ed Markey, a member of the House Homeland Security Committee. But first, for a look at the furious debate over port operation and port security, we're joined from Washington by Siobhan Gorman. She covers national security and intelligence for the Baltimore Sun. Siobhan, thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you.
So what's the latest off of Capitol Hill? A lot of hearings this week and pretty tough comments by Republican leaders there. The Bush administration says they're going to take, what, another 45 days to look again at the Dubai operating company. How's Congress responding?
Well, just about every hearing this week on Capitol Hill that had anything to do potentially with security was pulled into the ports debate. But I thought it was quite interesting that even after all the talk this week, an effort yesterday to get the House of Representatives just to vote on whether it might vote on legislation requiring Congress to have a final say in this particular ports deal actually failed along partisan lines.
Meaning after all the stormy pushback, this may just go through?
Well, I don't know if it means it'll go through, but it certainly points to the fact that even though we see a lot of criticism from Republicans, we saw yesterday that Republicans weren't willing yet to actually take a vote to kind of put their votes where their mouths are.
Interesting. Armed Services Committee Chairman in the House, Duncan Hunter, Republican, California. I think the Republican leadership in both houses will come to the conclusion that these aren't the folks you want to operate your ports. Yet you say that the vote is not there yet. Is there something that may be learned in this new 45-day examination of the Dubai company that could change the situation dramatically, Siobhan?
It's possible. I think that one of the issues that has come out of the discussions over the past week and a half or so is that we found that the intelligence investigation and sort of the investigation into the impact that the deal might have on vulnerabilities to a terrorist attack weren't really taken into account. So we'll have to see. There's been not so much information about how those considerations will be taken into account in this 45-day review. So there are a lot of questions still open.
Siobhan, the word we got from the Bush administration throughout when this first exploded into the news was that, look, it's not the private company that's responsible for security. It's the U.S. government. So don't worry. It doesn't matter who the operator is. Does that wash to you? You follow this closely.
Well, I mean, it is certainly true that the U.S. government is responsible for security at the ports, but I don't know that that should give you a great deal of confidence in the fact that security is being taken care of. I think that what it really does is raise questions about the overall security of all of our ports.
I mean, when you look at who loads and unloads the cargo, who hires and fires security personnel, who does background checks, who decides who gets access to the facility, all that, isn't that in the hands of the private industry operator?
Well, not this particular industry operator. The Dubai Ports deal has to do with a company that is responsible for the people who load and unload the shipping containers. So that's their piece of the security puzzle. You know, they do have control in terms of what actually goes on to ships and what comes off of ships. And that's obviously a piece of the security going on at a port, because what gets offloaded, could always contain something that we really don't want to have in our port. But it's really just one piece. As you point out, access to the ports is a huge problem. I mean, we don't have ID tags for port workers, and that means that they don't have rigorous background checks. And in addition, there are lots of people who have access to these facilities. Truckers, for example, who can just drive onto the port facility with a driver's license.
And that's all at the commercial level. Of course, the nightmare scenario is a bomb in one of those containers or the makings of one. How much has port security changed since 9/11? 11, Siobhan.
Well, there have been some efforts to especially put U.S. customs officials overseas at some of the major ports. I think there are 40-some ports now overseas where U.S. customs agents are doing the screening. The problem is that we just don't yet have the facilities overseas or at our own ports to really screen all of the containers, although there is one pilot project in Hong Kong that is potentially showing that that can be done.
So Hong Kong can do it, but the United States, not so clear, at least not done yet.
Yeah, and what's interesting is it's actually a port facility expert from the United States that is honchoing this pilot project in Hong Kong that will screen all of the containers using a combination of two technologies that are widely available.
Great. Bring him home quick. We need him. Siobhan Gorman, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure. Thank you.
Siobhan Gorman, national security and intelligence reporter for the Baltimore Sun. I'm joined now from Washington by Daniel Prieto. He's director of the Reform Institute's Homeland Security Center, co-author of a very soon-to-be-released Council on Foreign Relations study entitled Neglected Defense, Mobilizing the Private Sector to Support Homeland Security. Dan Prieto, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And with us from Washington, Danielle Bryan, executive director of the Project on Government Oversight. They've done a lot of work here, including on the RPG issue around nuclear power plants. Danielle, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel Prieto, first, your big conclusions. Is this partnership, is there a partnership between government and private industry? Is it working?
I think since 9/11, a lot of folks have talked about a partnership, but the reality that there it's much more talk than reality. And I think part of the problem is, in my view, and in the report forthcoming, it starts from a mistaken premise in government homeland security since 9/11, which is that, you know, the market for the most part, will provide for security, and only when the market fails should the government step in, and that leads to a number of big problems. First of all, it reduces urgency. Second of all, it abdicates the federal government of leadership on security issues, and defense has always been government's job. And finally, it leaves you in no position to have audits as to whether security measures are successful or not until after the fact.
Daniel Bryan, we're spending hundreds of billions abroad in Iraq. At home, it looks like the Congress, the government's been more chary on that. Are we doing a fraction of what we could? What are the vulnerabilities here?
Well, there's no question we're not doing what we could, and we're certainly not doing what we should. We see, certainly in the nuclear sector, which is actually theoretically sort of the best of the sectors when you look at the critical infrastructure. That is the one sector where there is a government agency that has the capacity to regulate security standards. And what we find is even though we do have that capacity, we are still finding industry has such a tremendous weight in forcing the government to really downplay its requirements. That RPG is the best example, where industry essentially pushed the Nuclear Regulatory Commission back and said, we just can't spend this money on this. You know, we can't afford it. And the government said, okay.
So we've got nuclear power plants, never mind chemical. We'll talk about them and the ports, but nuclear power plants. Of course, if they went down, blew up, you name it, the risk to millions is enormous. And what we're reading here is that the government's not requiring even a defense against the number of guys who hijacked the planes on 9/11, not against RPGs, which you can buy, we read, for $10 in Africa, rocket-propelled grenades. Is this serious, Daniel Bryan? Are we serious about national security if we've got these kind of gaping vulnerabilities at home?
I think we are not serious. What we're really are doing is having people within the Department of Homeland Security and other agencies in the government pointing fingers at industry, and industry is pointing fingers at the government, and as a result, no one's doing anything.
Daniel Prieto, what about the notion that the market should provide for security? What, you must have thought that through. Does it wash in the end? I mean, everybody's looking to the bottom line. The profit margin is going to be hit by these measures. These companies have insurance. If a chemical plant goes up and it's the cost of the plant that's covered, not the cost of the lives, does the market really work here?
I really think, this is Dan, Tom, that the market will only get you so far, and the Homeland Security strategies out of the White House and out of Congress recognize that. I think the problem by starting from that premise, though, again, as I mentioned before, mm-hmm. is the government fails to take up its leadership mantle. Backtracking on the nuclear issue, I think it's important to point out that there are requirements from the Nuclear Regulatory
NRC,
Commission, excuse
yep.
me.
Mm-hmm.
that require them to be protected against certain types of attacks. Those may not include RPGs at the moment, but they are as Danielle said, in many ways safer and more regulated and have more requirements on them than other industries.
But safer
however,
is nice, but if
it
it's not
very
safe
true.
Enough...
Take, for example, the chemical industry. Yeah. While it is true that they are still not secure enough, it's also a fact that large chemical manufacturers have spent $3 billion since 9/11 to improve security. So if the market itself is spending $3 billion on chemical, and if we decide as a society that that's not enough protection, it's clear that at that point, that's when the government should step in. And in fact, on chemicals, the large chemical manufacturers have been asking for regulation for the last couple of years and have not received it from the government because it actually helps them out by providing them a stable environment to know what to invest in and to know that to the extent they're investing, competitors are also being put in the position to invest in more security.
Right now, Kevin's calling from Mount Rainier, Maryland. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I'm very concerned about nuclear security. For instance, in Maryland, there's the Calvert Cliffs Nuclear Power Plant.
Where is that exactly, Kevin, compared
it's
to...
It's on the Chesapeake Bay.
Okay.
It's south of Annapolis,
yep.
Not far from Baltimore.
Of course, got it.
And Baltimore Gas and Electric wants to build a third reactor there, and they want to ship high-level radioactive waste on the Chesapeake up to the port of Baltimore.
Yep.
And it looks like the Bush administration is about to roll back transport regulations in order to get the waste moving out to the Nevada dump site at Yucca Mountain.
So railway security here, moving that highly volatile material is the issue.
Well, this is on barges on the Chesapeake.
Okay,
it's on
okay.
railroads, it's on highways, through like 45 states.
And
it's really a vulnerable terrorist target because there are anti-tank weapons that can blow these containers apart and release catastrophic amounts of radiation.
And you're talking about your home turf there. Kevin, thanks for your call. Danielle Bryan, I mean, there's a lot of stuff to be moved around a huge economy like the United States. Nuclear power plants are an important energy provider. Is it possible to lock down everything? When Kevin's worried about that in his backyard, is that a reasonable worry, or is this a level of risk we have to live with?
It is a reasonable worry, and I don't think we have to live with it. I think really what is missing here is leadership on the part of the government. We've given industry 4 years, almost 5 years since 9/11, to show that they were serious about increasing security. I know Dan was talking about how the chemical industry has spent a lot of money to increase security. What I think needs to happen now is for the government to then actually test at a certain standard whether it's adequate or not. It's not good enough to have self-regulation from my perspective.
And Daniel Prieto, what about it? Kevin says, I don't want this stuff shipped around without better security than it's got, but he feels the government pushing against doing that. What's the rationale for not having more security there?
I don't know what the rationale is in this particular case. I think the caller points out, though, what is a concern, the continued insecurity of transportation of hazmat.
Hazardous materials,
whether it's in the area around here, and it's a concern in New York with the bridges and tunnels there.
Sure.
The issue there is obviously, Tom, you can't lock everything down. Our economy would grind to a halt. On the other hand, there is progress to be made between absolutely locking everything down and having a situation where companies are still not in a good position, for example, and as an analogy, this is analogous to the cargo security stuff, to track where all these things are at any given point and to have real-time information as to where they're located. If they disappear off the grid, then it should trigger some security plan to find out where it went. And someone has to do a serious cost-benefit analysis of what it would take to make individual rail cars or trucks more secure against these things. I think after the Exxon Valdez accident, people started putting double-hull containers on oil ships, and it ended up, in my view, being effective and costing less money than people thought and actually having the benefit of reducing the liability of accidents.
Yeah, I mean, I think Americans are very reasonable people. It's not easy to make everything perfectly secure. That may be a dream, but when we're being asked to make very serious changes in our civil liberties, we're spending very serious money in Iraq, and if we leave these huge vulnerabilities at home, not doing what can be done, well, that's a head-turner. I want to welcome another voice in here. Brian Bender is a reporter for the Boston Globe, national security correspondent there, wrote this week about a really interesting story of a power plant, nuclear plant, in Connecticut. Brian, thanks for being with us.
Sure.
Tell us the story. You've got a plant in Connecticut, and what was going on?
Well, the Millstone Nuclear Power Station in Waterford is dealing with a whistleblower case. There's a employee there who raised some concerns going back a couple of years about the perimeter security system, the sort of electronic cameras and sensors that defend the plant raised some concerns that it wasn't working properly, and that at some points they were even turning it off because it was such a nuisance. And this employee has been relieved of his duties and is fighting to get reinstated. He claims that he was removed from his job because of his for raising these concerns, but the company Dominion Nuclear claims that his position was downsized and that it had nothing to do with him raising these concerns and that they have a handle on it.
But you say some concerns, but you're talking about here as many as 1,000 false alarms a day from perimeter security just became an annoyance. So motion sensors, security cameras just purposely turned off. He speaks up about it and the hatchet comes down.
Right. Well, I mean, that's, again, that's the allegation he's making.
Right.
The state of Connecticut, the Department of Public Utility Control, is investigating his claims. He's also filed a complaint with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Department of Labor. So it's being investigated. But at this point, the company doesn't want to talk about security issues, nor does the federal government, and they say that they're on top of it.
So, do you have a sense, Brian, of what the vulnerable population is in the, the kind of vulnerable perimeter of that particular nuclear plant? Are we talking thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people if there was a problem there?
I'm not an expert when it comes to that, but certainly government officials as far away as New York have raised concerns about this. This is across Long Island Sound. But certainly, anyone living within the immediate area would be at risk if indeed someone could get into the plant and cause some sort of radiological sabotage.
And here we've got the security being turned off because wind and waves and birds are shutting off and it's too much trouble. Brian Bender, thanks for your reporting. Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Brian Bender with the Boston Globe. Danielle, Brian, what are the standards of NRC nuclear plant, commercial plant security here, and how do they look compared to the potential threat?
Well, it was actually extraordinary. When 9/11 happened, those plants were only protecting against the possibility of 3 terrorists coming after them. Now they've only raised their standards to about 5 or 6. The actual number is classified.
So Daniel's saying we've got standards here, but it's standards that require defense against a half a dozen max.
And knowing that we had 19 terrorists in 9/11, it's extraordinary. This is a debate we're having constantly with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. How can you in good conscience say this is good enough? We already know, and military history has shown, that teams of attackers are always at least in the 12 to 14 people range. And it's unconscionable that they're protecting against so few people, because ultimately it comes down to money. It costs more to protect against more people.
So is that the issue? I mean, if one of these plants would go, no one's going to turn around and say, why did you spend that extra $100,000 or $500,000? I mean, we're spending hundreds of billions in Iraq on security.
I think with the nuclear industry, it is not a tremendously economically viable industry. It's, gets a lot of government subsidy already. I think it really does come down to money. Forcing them to have the standards really that we believe they should have will mean a lot of money, and who's going to pay for it? If the government makes a public policy decision that nuclear energy is an essential part of our our energy grid, then maybe the government needs to pay for it. The thing that I find is so troubling is we know what security should be. It's just that no one is agreeing to pay for it.
Daniel Prieto, is it affordable for an economy the size of America's with all the vulnerable plants? We're reading here about thousands of chemical plants that could endanger maybe up to 10,000 people, or maybe 100 that could endanger a million apiece. Can we afford it as a country, as an economy?
I think you have to be a little more nuanced with the question. It's really, can you afford to protect better the things that you decide are priorities? I think that's one huge problem, is that while required by the Homeland Security Act to prioritize these targets and decide what's more important to protect than another thing, that still hasn't been done this far after 9/11. And that's a serious problem, because that allows you no roadmap to think through strategically how you're going to spend your money. Moving beyond that, though, I think it's widely accepted that a certain number of sectors are more dangerous than others. Chemical, hazardous materials transport, nuclear, the energy grid, oil and gas facilities, things like that. And the other thing I think is worth pointing out here is that the government, as it thinks about how to spend in these sectors, they have to really understand the wherewithal and the capability of each particular industry to protect itself. Danielle did a good job of pointing out that nuclear facilities have low growth, they have don't have a lot of cash flow, they have low profit margins, and it's exactly the same thing with chemical industries. If your industry, in its basic core business model, is not going to have a lot of spare resources to spend on security, then it becomes pretty clear pretty quickly that that's an industry where the government better step in pretty quickly. On the other hand, finance companies and technology companies do a very good job of protecting against cybersecurity and hacker attacks on a daily basis. And why is that? They're higher growth industries. They have more cash flow. They have more resources to spend on it. And those types of facilities are attacked every day by common criminals.
Of course, they're not attacked by typically by RPGs. Here we're talking about huge tank farms. I mean, could it be that it's just not affordable at the private level, that we should have a National Guard or U.S. military around some of these plants? Can it be done privately? Does it need to be subsidized or just send in the troops?
Danielle probably knows better than I do, but I think at nuclear plants, right, Danielle, there is a federalization of some of the security guards, or maybe I'm off base. I don't remember.
No, actually, okay. there isn't. There was a proposal that happen, but that's been pretty much party line, and so it... Frankly, I think what it's come down to is the Republicans have been concerned that if you create an entirely new federal force, that is government employees tend to vote Democratic. And so, interestingly, it has not happened. So what we have is, in fact, that's the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's defense of their current standards is, well, this is as much as you can ask a private security force to handle. And if that is true, which I'm not sure I would agree with that statement. But even if you accept that statement, that doesn't get us to where we need to go, which is, but that doesn't help that community. I mean, some of the nuclear power plants, I think, should be a higher priority than others. I mean, as Dan was pointing out, some sectors are higher priority, but within the nuclear sector, for example, Indian Point, right outside New York City, that should be number one focus to make sure, because of the tremendous population around there, that there is absolutely adequate security there.
And yet, Danielle Bryan, look, we saw 9/11. How much bigger warning do you need? I mean, if we can afford it as a nation, if we can afford it as an economy, given what Daniel Prieto says, you've got to prioritize, fine, let's prioritize. But a nuclear plant right outside New York City or other major cities, 100 chemical plants that could kill a million, that doesn't sound that difficult to prioritize.
What we see is, because of 9/11, we had a lot of focus on the airports and airline security, because that's what we saw. There seems little creativity in thinking maybe we won't see exactly the same attacks in the future. Every sector is saying, well, it hasn't happened to us yet. I mean, the nuclear industry's excuse for why they argued against protecting nuclear power plants against RPGs is RPGs have never been used in the United States before. Well, you know, any day you open the newspaper, you'll see terrorists or rebels or civil wars around the world with people using RPGs.
Yeah.
So we know they're out there.
Hardly difficult.
They just haven't been used here yet.
Hardly difficult to imagine. Daniel Prieto, describe the chemical risk to us. I think that's not widely understood. What kind of chemicals and what kind of locations present the greatest risk?
The chemicals that pose the greatest risk are called TIH chemicals, toxic by inhalation. And one great example is chlorine, which is used to sort of purify water and exists, in large storage tanks, exists at the manufacturers. They can't go in rail cars. I think they moved them, but at least a year or two ago, within a mile or two of Capitol Hill.
This is not somewhere all in the Nevada desert. This is near densely populated urban centers.
Very much so, because those chemicals are essential to sort of daily basic things like clean water, and as a result, they end up having to pass through or be stored near large population centers as well as passing through remote places. So things like that are the things that are most dangerous, and again, they can be targeted where they're being stored, where they're being manufactured, or while they're on our rails or on our roads. At the same time, as we talked about before, it's difficult to lock these things down because we'll stop functioning as an economic society if we do lock them all down.
But you could protect them. We remember, a year or two ago, the 60 Minutes cameras were just walking right in to fairly deadly chemical plants, basically just howdy-do and strolling in. It could have been anybody.
Absolutely. And I think the problem there with chemical plants, you know, there's some disagreement between EPA and DHS on how many pose the highest risk. But it is certainly true that in the level of hundreds, there are a number of chemical plants that, you know, can kill or injure 10,000 people or more. So the issue there is if private industry, 4 years after 9/11, 5 years after, is not doing enough, at this point, it is essential for the government to step in and say, you know what, we haven't been regulating you. Here are some basic standards and guidelines you have to abide by, and let's get this done.
We're going to hear about some possibilities on that front. Danielle Bryan, do you see the political willingness in the U.S. government to do that?
We're just not seeing it. I wonder why, honestly, this isn't seen as sort of a heroic step to come forward through DHS and say, this is what we're going to do. These are our standards. We're going to protect our people. And you just see none of that.
Let me get another call right now from Augusta, Georgia. Michael's calling. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you? Yes, I'm a nurse at a facility in Augusta, Georgia, and I happen to be involved in the treatment of several patients who suffered the consequences of a chlorine gas leak last year in Grantville, South Carolina.
Was it a big leak, Michael, a big one or a small one?
Well, this is considered a minor leak, but that due to human error, a rail car was derailed and their chlorine tank was overturned and resulted in the deaths of about a dozen people.
That's right. I remember. And you saw that firsthand.
Yes, I did. And many people aren't aware. I mean, had that chlorine tank exploded, it would have caused much more damage. And I think it's incumbent upon the chemical industry to do what they can. And if the government has to force them to do that, to do what they can to ensure the safety, because this is real.
If it had exploded, let's say, with an explosive attached or fired at it, we've got the picture and you've seen the consequences up close. Right now I want to turn to Arlington, Virginia, and Marty Durbin. He's Managing Director of Federal Affairs for the American Chemistry Council. That's, of course, a big lobbying group for the chemical industry. Mr. Durbin, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
So help us understand what's going on here. We read about all kinds of plants, thousands of plants that could mean thousands of lives if they blew up. Maybe 100, we read, in 23 states that could threaten a million or more people. The chemical industry spent several billion dollars, but is it doing what could be done? As an American citizen, do you feel safe and satisfied for yourself, your kids at night?
Well, I got to tell you, obviously I can only speak for the members of the American Chemistry Council, but we're doing quite a bit. I mean, you mentioned the billions of dollars we've invested. I mean, this is a responsibility that we have. Our member companies know they have this responsibility. They established a code of conduct, our own security code, that required every one of our facilities to do vulnerability assessments and implement security plans, and then have third parties come in and verify that. But, you know, Tom, having said that, we also realize that we aren't all of those facilities, and so that's why we have been up in Congress trying to get federal legislation enacted to make sure that all chemical facilities take the same kinds of aggressive actions that we've taken.
Well, clearly a level playing field would make it easier. If it's just one company that's going to spend the extra money, then they're going to be disadvantaged. But to your assertion that you're looking for this legislation, I mean, are you really? Or cut that a little finer for us. I'm looking at an email here that appears to have come from you guys to your allies on the Hill about some legislation on rail security, saying we've asked everyone to contact members of the committee and urge them to reject the Markey amendments. I hope we talk to Ed Markey in a second. Here's another one on a highway bill on the Senate floor. And again, I think this is email from your counsel saying bill managers will attempt to table the amendments if offered. ACC has worked with coalition partners. What coalition?
Well, Tom, yeah, we, there's no question. We want to get legislation enacted. Now, you know,
really? This doesn't sound like it.
Well, but you know, certainly we're going to take positions on specific pieces of legislation, and we may not always agree with the approach. But what we do want to see and what we have been trying to get enacted is legislation that would set national standards and require vulnerability assessments and implementation of security plans at chemical facilities, and those would be enforced by the Department of Homeland Security. I mean, the chemical industry is a critical part of our national infrastructure and has to be and needs to be protected. But again, we have a role to play there, and the government has an appropriate role to play there.
Danielle Bryan, how do you see it? The American Chemistry Council as a friend of American security or dragging its heels?
Well, I just want to ask, who was it that stopped the legislation that was introduced the last 4 years doing exactly that, asking for federal standards, asking DHS to be able to regulate chemical industry security standards.
Marty Durbin, wasn't that your group pushing against that? Was it the problem with the details, or why?
In the last 3 years, we have been pushing for legislation, have been supporting legislation to move forward. We worked with in the last Congress with the Environment and Public Works Committee. This Congress, we've worked very closely with the Homeland Security Committee and the Senate, and are right now working and trying to help Senator Collins and Senator Lieberman move their legislation toward a markup.
Daniel Prieto, is that your sense, that this has been a gung-ho pro-security organization industry in the United States?
The American Chemistry Council has done a lot, and I want to support Marty on that. It is true. I've seen the letter that his organization has sent to Susan Collins supporting the legislation for standards for chemical facilities. So that is very much a fact. To the extent that there is disagreement about particulars, you mentioned the transportation bill that Congressman Markey supports. You know, I was on the Hill as well, and I saw versions of that. As I recall, that would require rerouting a lot of chemicals away from the major cities in a way that you know, those are legitimate policy arguments. I don't think it puts ACC in the position of being a bad actor. I think what needs to happen here, though, is to try to move the debate from saying, you know, industry's bad and not doing enough and making someone culpable as a whipping boy on these issues and actually getting to the point where public-private partnership actually exists. It is true that the ACC has been asking for standards legislation for the last couple of years.
But it's almost 5 years since 9/11, and it hasn't happened. We want to understand why. Marty Durbin, can this be done? To the extent that there is resistance, and I assume it's not all just about fine points and details, what's the industry position here? Does the chemical industry in America think you can have real security around these most dangerous facilities, or do you just believe it's simply too expensive and at some point we just have to live with that risk?
If we thought it was too expensive, we wouldn't have spent $3 billion since 9/11 enhancing security.
Well, it could cost $30 billion. $30 billion could be too expensive for it.
Absolutely. This is something that has to be done. It's not whether or not it can be done. I mean, we're very clear on what our position is and saying that we need to have national standards in place to make sure that that this sector and every other sector that we're connected to is appropriately protected.
Could 60 Minutes still saunter into big chemical facilities with their camera and sort of, you know, stand up on a tank and holler?
If they can, it would be unacceptable. And that's why the American Chemistry Council has set out these standards and guidelines to make sure that we're constantly looking at ways of improving security at our facilities. That is our commitment, and we will continue to do so. Whether or not we have legislation, I can guarantee you the members of the American Chemistry Council are going to continue to do what's necessary to protect our facilities.
But we're told it's not being done right now. So do you need legislation to level the playing field, to force everybody to do it? Even with your $3 billion, we're told we've got vulnerabilities all over the place. Why is that?
There are inherent vulnerabilities throughout our economy and throughout our country, but that's why for this sector, while we think we've set the bar for how to manage chemical facility security, and we think that we now have to have national standards in place to make sure the entire sector is doing that.
That might help get the bar set higher. Danielle?
I just wanted to point out that about a month ago, the Government Accountability Office, which is the research office, an investigative office for the Congress,
right,
issued a report on chemical security, which was really fascinating. But it did point out, and I don't know what industry association, it certainly may not be Mr. Durbin's association that was pushing against this legislation, but there has been exactly this legislation introduced for the last 4 years, and the GAO pointed out that it has failed. So the point is, if the government thinks it's a good idea and industry thinks it's a good idea, there's something wrong if it's not happening.
I mean, I'm reading here, U.S. News and World Report, January 23rd this year, that's 1 month ago, more than 4 years after 9/11, modest improvements in airline security, port security, border security, but critics say virtually zero progress in protecting the nation's chemical plants. It doesn't sound good. I want to turn to Washington right now for one more voice. Congressman Ed Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts. He's a member of the House Select Committee on Homeland Security. He's made a lot of noise about industry vulnerability in this country. Congressman Markey, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So how do things stand here going on 5 years after 9/11? What's the gap between lip and cup on doing what we could reasonably do to protect ports, nuclear plants, chemical facilities? How close or far away are we?
Well, the president has basically given a blank check to fight the war in Iraq, but here in the United States, and we know that well in Boston, Al-Qaeda wants to attack us here. It's unbelievable, but all these years later, there still is no requirement that the cargo which goes onto passenger planes in our country is screened. there still is no requirement that chemical companies place security around their plants in a way that the federal government is testing. There is still a system at nuclear power plants where they can hire a rent-a-cop security system,
right,
and then have their security tested by Whack-A-Hut itself, not by some other federal security force. And as you go down the list, you realize that the Bush administration responds to the private sector's complaints that it will cost too much. And on the other hand, the Bush administration also says that they don't want to spend federal money. So inside of that regulatory black hole could come the Al-Qaeda attack that once again terrorizes our country.
Congressman Markey, we've got with us on the line Marty Durbin from the American Chemistry Council. He says, look, we've spent $3 billion on security. We're all for legislation. We want to do the right thing here. Is that the way it looks to you?
No, it doesn't look that way at all to me. The standard is still voluntary at the for chemical plants around the country. There is no federal standard for what the test should be to make sure that these plants are secure. And by the way, a report which I asked to be done revealed that there are more than 100 facilities in 23 states that could threaten 1 million or more people if there was a successful attack against the chemical plant. And so here, as in just about every other area, the Bush administration refuses to come in and to impose tough standards which will ensure that Al-Qaeda would have a very difficult time in creating that catastrophic event which they are pledging to do inside of our country.
Congressman Ed Markey in Washington, thanks for joining us. Marty Durbin, do you welcome tough standards from the federal government? You got 20 seconds.
Absolutely. That's what we've been calling for. There are tough standards that exist right now that the Coast Guard enforces on within the Maritime Transportation Security Act. So there are already about 250 chemical facilities, many of our members, that are regulated on security. And I will point out that the Coast Guard looked at our program, Responsible Care Security Code, and deemed that it met the regulations, and we now use that our members can use as an alternative security plan.
So you say bring them on. We'll be watching and listening. Marty Durbin with the American Chemistry Council, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Daniel Bryan at the Project on Government Oversight and Daniel Prieto at the Reform Institute's Homeland Security Center, thanks to both of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.